Talk given Friday, 2nd November 1973. It is natural for people to react to the weather conditions. When the skies are very grey, there are heavy clouds lowering, and the condition continues for hours and sometimes for days, people feel depressed. Maybe the clouds burst down upon us in heavy rain or snow, as the case may be. And yet it is rather interesting that this which depresses at first gives forth water, pure water, which may have disastrous effects in terms of flood, or one may see the other side of it. Without water we can't live. And the water is needed to fertilize the fields and so forth. Our existence depends upon it. There is a complete interplay with the elements of nature, the elements which compose our very being. Or again, out of the black clouds, everything seems utterly black. You get pure white snow falling. See the contrast there. The black clouds, the white snow. What sort of symbolism can we read into it? Out of the darkness, out of that which depresses, painful, we get this absolutely pure white snow. An unspeakable whiteness and a silence. And the snow itself is composed of marvelous crystals. And you get glittering points of light when the sun shines and the light is reflected back. Seems as if the wealth of the world is around you for the asking. And yet it is only an illusion. But the beauty is there. And we exercise preference with regard to that beauty. We don't see the whole of the beauty. We are not sensitive to that. We are not sensitive to the beauty of the dark, lowering clouds holding menace. Something which we dislike, react against. We wish things otherwise. And the fact remains, we do get depressed with it all. And perhaps these black clouds may symbolize the conflict, the sorrow of the world, the pain that there is in the world, and our aversion to it, our constant wishing, wanting that it were otherwise. and we form pictures in our own mind as to what that otherwise ought to be, which would be pleasant to us and agreeable to us. But when this sorrow strikes home to strikes home, people turn to certain things for comfort, for strength, for consolation, for trying to make what is other than what it is, without taking the trouble really to understand it, to live with it, to be in such complete harmony with the totality, with beauty in its essence, in its perfection and wholeness, that they only remain in a fragmentary state. So they turn to drink or tobacco or sex or drugs or whatever it is, some form of self-indulgence which brings about forgetfulness, never recognizing that what we are trying to forget is the fact that we are men, intended to be full humans, and not remain in the subhuman state of mere reaction against the unpleasant actuality, unpleasant to us. Or people turn to religion, to philosophy, to various cults. They join societies, all sects, S-E-C-T-S, in order to produce for them the happy state. This refusal to face life in its wholeness, this refusal to go right within the self and recognize that there is no such thing as the understanding of the self unless there is also the understanding of the not-self, and vice versa. There is no such thing as understanding not-self without also understanding the self. Because self and not-self are one whole reality. So they take to various disciplines, including the discipline of yoga, or the contemplative life, or the monastic discipline, or whatever it is. They take to all these things in order to produce a desirable result, something which is self-oriented. And this precisely, everlastingly defeats religious living. And, in a sense, more important, human living. Let us try and consider together this business of man's sorrow, which means our own sorrow, difficulty, trouble, and so forth, and try and understand this situation. And remember the meaning of the word consider. Perhaps it will bear repetition, although you have heard me talk about it before. Con, together with. Sidus, sideris, a star. What is a star but a self-shining light? It doesn't reflect light from outside. It shines from within itself, and it shines by virtue of the fact that it continuously pours out all its life, its energy, its power, without let or hindrance, without calculation. It is absolutely itself. There are no self-considerations involved in the star. There is no self-orientation. Nor is there a self-orientation by identification with some great cause or some noble purpose to be served and all that sort of thing. It just pours out its life, its heat, its light, its energy, its everything. And it's a self-shining light. Now, to consider means that you and I, therefore, in the fullest and the finest sense of the term, commune together. I am only the mouth and the voice of the speech of your own hearts. Otherwise, I cannot talk. So, to consider means that we together will look into this self-shining light. Just look at it. Where is this light? What is this light? Is it not the light of transcendence itself embodied in each one of us? The light which is dimmed by the darkness caused by our misplaced attention to things, our being captivated by the ephemeral, attractive veils of reality. For after all that we experience empirically is but the changing garb, and it is the mortal garb of the immortal, which is beyond all shape and form and substance and all the rest of it. So, this light is within us. And if we are to consider it, let us try and consider it as human beings. And as you know already, the word human means the happy, creative thinker. The Sanskrit hu or su means the happy, the well-made, the well-done, or whatever it is. And man means, manyate, the verb, the root man, means the thinker. But be very careful here. None of us is a thinker in that sense of the term. Because thought in this context, which is the context of transcendence itself, is not our discursive talking within our own minds at all. It has no relationship to it whatsoever. But the thinking, the vision, the seeing is identical with the action which is creation. It is creative activity. This is the meaning of human. See, the word human actually is identical with the conceptual presentation of God as God the Creator. And God said, and it was, whatever He said. But instead of saying God said, one should say God minded. God thought. And it is not discursive chatter. It's creative action. Now, if we consider together, that is to say, we can only try to consider together that way, this self-shining light which is transcendence embodied in us, extraordinary things happen. The whole of our ego-centered, self-oriented worldliness is turned inside out, and one lives as a human being, as a religious being. Because that's what the human really is, fundamentally a religious being. One lives thus, and in living thus, one is manifesting, actually representing in flesh and blood, and in everyday action, that which he actually is growing into. To use the words in the golden verses of Pythagoras, you discover that you are an immortal God. Now, this is the deep meaning of yoga, surely. And this is something which cannot be attained, achieved. It cannot be obtained. It cannot be gathered from outside. Remember the star, the self-shining light. Its essential nature is made manifest, that is all. There are no obstructions to the full and free manifestation of its essential nature. But we human beings, as we call ourselves, we are an animal species which is very strange, which is very unusual, quite different from all the other animal species of the world. We have the power of choice, we have the power to thwart the trend of life, the purpose of our existence in this world. We have that power. Also, we are unfortunately in the ignorant state. And it's a curious kind of ignorance. It is a cunning, knowing ignorance. Strangely paradoxical statement to make. It is a knowing ignorance. And why do I call it a knowing ignorance? Because any one of us, when he makes a mistake, when he does something wrong, when he feels or thinks or says or does that which is morally wrong, he knows it. This inner ethical sense, which is deep in us, is inseparable from the reality of transcendence embodied in our own being. But that transcendence never imposes, never compels. That is the extraordinary way in which transcendence acts. Transcendence never compels. The power, the creative power of transcendence is virtue itself. Virtue which is completely outside the ambivalent sphere which we are acquainted with, where our ethical life is concerned, namely the struggle between virtue and vice. There is no ambivalence in that virtue. That virtue is the strength, the power, the beauty, the wisdom, the love of transcendence itself. We use these words. Transcendence doesn't use the words. It just is. We have to use the words to talk about it. If even the glimmer of a sense of transcendence has begun to awaken in us. And this virtue is the omnipotence of transcendence. And this omnipotence never imposes itself. It doesn't bide its time. It is action in eternity. And in that action in eternity is involved the whole of the time process and the unfolding process of life. The religious man, the yogi, the mystic, whoever you like, His task, his work is to wake up to this sort of thing and be in harmony with it. Be in harmony not with effort, but effortlessly. The action which is right action for us in this matter, the outer world may call a great effort. But you will find that if your natural interest and if your wholehearted love and devotion goes into it, just flows into it, for you it becomes effortless. This is the charm of it. That is why the Buddha talked of the deep states into which one can enter, the deep states of communion with the totality, as states which were characterized by extraordinary ease, a state of ease. And that's the word he uses. Rather matter-of-fact, rather dry if you like, but nevertheless extraordinarily true. It is a state of complete ease, this state of communion, being at home in the cosmos. So, transcendence never compels. Transcendence is effortless. Transcendence has no self-orientation. That is the secret of it. We are self-oriented. So we seek this and we seek that and we want to achieve this and we want to achieve that and get rid of this and have that instead. The fundamental error by which all mankind lives, whether it be in the name of religion and yoga and mysticism and the cause and serving God, or whether it be in terms of just giving, being self-indulgent with drugs, drink, sex, anything you like. They are no different one from the other. In terms of the vision of totality, of the wholeness. Do realize this. Because when man seeks as a result of his own desire, there is a contrary force always set up, mainly in the unconscious parts of one's being. Why is there this contrary force? Or rather, let me put it this way, how is there this contrary force? It is that which the conscious mind rejects, which it doesn't want, and it won't tackle it, it won't accept the responsibility of wholeness. So, as we saw in the beginning, the black clouds, which we dislike, grey skies, isn't it awful weather, we say. What is there awful about it? From them, from those clouds, come the waters of life. If one understands that, and is free of aversion, but has this real understanding, not a mere logical intellectual thing, but a true understanding, then there is love for the black clouds. And those black clouds will pour out the pure waters which fertilize, which sustain and nourish and heal. And they'll fall perhaps as snow, such exquisite beauty around. And when the sun shines again, your heart dances for joy in stillness and in silence. Without grasping at that joy. That is the whole point. It moves, it passes on. This is yoga. But for all that, it's essential that there should be the purification of the mind and the heart first. Otherwise, any activity which one indulges in. In order to produce a result without the basis of complete purity to start with, all that activity releases power, psychical power, mental power, spiritual power, transcendent energy, which energizes every aspect of our being. I have said this before, several times as you know, but it can bear repetition over and over again, because we all fall into this trap. We are caught up by our reactions. We are the slaves of our preferential choice and our desire, and therefore we go the way of destruction. But be free of desire. Be free of ambition, wanting to achieve, to attain. Be free of the fear which makes us cowards where facing life in its totality is concerned. Let us be ready to accept the situation, or rather, no, not accept, because then we'll have the contrary, reject, but to live through the situation so completely, so wholly, giving ourselves entirely to the situation, so entirely that all self-concern is out. Then you are not isolated from truth. Because the truth is what is actually present. There is no truth to seek there. You don't have to move out there or try to turn inwards in order to catch hold of transcendence. Have you ever tried catching hold of transcendence? What's the kitten chasing its own tail? Can't do it. These are wasted energies. We will get worldly results, yes. Oh yes, my health is better, I've become slim, I'm getting successful, I'm dominating the other fellow, mastering him, and all that shit. But this is the way of the devil. This is the way of evil. Now you see, we don't do it consciously. It happens unconsciously. And it happens unconsciously because we won't wake up to the whole reality. That is why. Now I said, the essential basis is purity. You look into the Upanishads carefully, and you'll find the emphasis laid upon Yama and Niyama. The moralities, the religious observances, what Christian mysticism called the external instruments of grace, and so forth. To enter into that state of grace. And the Upanishads particularly expound this very, very fully. Patanjali also mentions it in his yoga aphorisms. But he mentions fewer items as compared with an Upanishad like the Shandilya Upanishad. And the yoga Upanishads, Shandilya, the Yoga Tattva, Dhyanabindu, the whole lot of them, they give considerable details as to the right sort of asceticism, the right sort of abstemiousness. You know that I always define asceticism this way. When you see for yourself that this is not necessary for the fulfillment of man, when you really see it and understand, it just drops off. You don't have to struggle. And this is a very important point, because those of us, and when I say those of us, I don't mean just us here, but the world over, who are really earnest and sincere and longing to live the good life, They are so conditioned with the idea of fighting the good fight and so forth, that they try to wage war against vice. But any war game leads to wounds and death. So, the net result is that we go the way of all flesh, death, without having even had anything like the vision of reality, of truth. Instead of that, play the game of life with transcendence, instead of the game of war with vice. And how does one play this game of life with transcendence? You know that in a game, one person makes a move and the game starts, and whoever is the other partner in the game or the other team makes a response. If the other person or team doesn't make the response, that's the end of the game. In this game of life with transcendence, which you or I may play with transcendence, it seems as if there are two who are playing the game. Now, out of modesty or uncertainty, one may say, let transcendence make the first move. I don't know. I'm ignorant. I'm incapable. But the very fact that one has this sensitivity arising out of one makes oneself make the first move. Now, this is the omnipotence of transcendence. No compulsion. No suggestion comes from transcendence. It is transcendence within us which, because of a certain amount of obstruction being out, enables us to make the first move. And then, do you think transcendence answers? No. Transcendence remains silent, wrapped in the folds of eternity. In silent folds. It is I who make the next move on behalf of transcendence. Not because I see it, but because this first move happens to be the right move, it holds within itself that power and energy which will inevitably produce the right result, the move by transcendence itself. In ordinary language, it has been put in so many other religions, you take one step towards God and God takes 7 leagues towards you. But then you get the idea of two separate people. I'm trying to be free of this separateness, this isolativeness, which is the root of our sorrows and troubles and all the rest of it. No, it's you yourself, transcendence within, which produces this action. And this is one of the deep meanings of the word karma, again. So, in order to play this game of life with transcendence, because now action will be virtuous in the real sense, without any conflict of the ambivalent virtue-vice state, in this transcendent virtue, pure virtue functions naturally, spontaneously, happily. And when it functions this way, you will discover there's an extraordinary change in your attentiveness, the way you attend to things. How do we live through the day? Excepting through paying attention to what is happening. All the time we have to pay attention. You get up in the morning and start shaving, well, you have got to pay attention, otherwise there'll be nice red streaks all over the place. You see, you have to pay attention all the time, all the time. But what sort of attentiveness do we exercise through the day? Our attentiveness is tainted through and through with selfness. We attend to anything and everything in terms of what can I get out of this, what can I achieve with that, what can I attain through this, how can I aggrandize myself, fulfill some ambition, etc., etc., etc. The attention isn't pure. It is narrow, it is egoistic, it is self-centered, it is self-oriented. Directed towards oneself, grasping from the world for this oneself. And this completely defeats all religious living. You may follow the principles laid down by St. Ignatius of Loyola or the Shankaracharya of wherever it is, or Jesus Christ or the Buddha, and it is futile. So, when one begins to see that one is attending in this self-centered way, this selfish way, once you really see that, then you will find yourself beginning quite naturally to attend rightly. The world doesn't exist for my benefit. Nor do I exist for the benefit of the world. When we think and talk in those terms, we separate out oneself and the world. The fundamental duality, which means everlasting conflict as long as we live. But when the attentiveness becomes whole attentiveness, there is no isolative self-consciousness present. You are attending so completely that the separation between self and not self, which is a false separation, has completely vanished. The separation is a reality insofar as the world in its physical manifestation is concerned. There are separate physical objects. People, things, animals, trees, stones, stars, everything. Separate objects. In that sense, there is separation. But in our awareness of this total world, the separation is our fundamental sin and our fundamental ignorance. Then, when attentiveness becomes the right sort of attentiveness, this separation is gone. What is there to attain, to grasp, to achieve? Nothing at all. The essential isness of the totality in its purity, unobstructed by my ignorance and folly, is present here all the time. And then, with that state of attentiveness, you will find that there is the end of wishing things otherwise. Not that you will not act in such a manner as to change the ugly into the beautiful, the disharmonious into the harmonious, but with this totally different consciousness at work, this totally different mind at work, your action will be pure action, and that is yoga. Yoga is skill in action, as Sri Krishna said. And it means lesser forms. In its kindergarten meanings, this skill in action means doing whatsoever you have to do every day of your life as perfectly as possible. Yes. But that is your kindergarten stage. This profounder meaning of skill in action is that all action then is creative action, and it has ceased to be your action. As far as you are concerned, it is in action which you manifest. Because action as we, as humans as we are in the world, manifest, the action which we manifest is a destructive, divisive action, sundering the fundamental unity of the universe. And this attentiveness then wakes up to the reality of the light of transcendence within ourselves, the self-shining light, the star. Now, in that state of attentiveness, one has entered the realm of true consideration. And where there is such true consideration, the fountains of compassion open up. And the waters of life flow easily. These are not mere words of poetical fancies, if they are poetical at all. They are not fancies. These are realities. These are not flights of idealism. You know that one of the greatest scientists of our century, Eddington, who was Plumian professor of astronomy in Cambridge, in one of his books points out that the scientist thinks that he is an objective observer. He is nothing of the sort. He is very, very personal and subjective. He chooses the evidence which his experiments reveal in order to support his particular hunch. And that is a minor point, but the most tremendous thing in that book of his, this is the Tanner Lectures of 1936, he states that the only objective realities are, this is a scientist, mind you, one of the most brilliant scientists of the world, of this century, the only objective realities are life, mind, consciousness. What you can't put into a test tube, what you cannot smell, taste, touch, hold, picture, these are the objective realities. But you see, even a great scientist makes a statement like that. He must have seen truth as few religious people ever see. So now, with that purity, the end of any conflict of virtue-vice, the pure virtue functioning, then all discipline of the body, of breathing, the actual practice of meditation, if it's a specific practice, all that becomes meaningful. And it brings about real good, a good which you or I cannot see. If you or I can see it and evaluate it, then it is tainted with worldliness, with the mortal self, casting the shadow of death over that which is truly immortal. We have had, through the world's history, so many religious teachings. But the forms in which they have been couched, with very rare exceptions here and there in each and every one of the religions, the forms in which they have been couched are faulty. This, of necessity, is always the case. What I am saying is also faulty. What element in it or elements in it seem to be, yes, this is true, this is light, this is pure, perhaps for now may appear so, but the time comes when one goes beyond it. All these things are the passing veils. But once this light of transcendence from within really bursts into flame, then the real yoga has begun. The real contemplation of the mystic has begun. The real life of pure action of the worker for the world has begun. And it's a flame which doesn't scorch, but warms. It's a flame which casts light upon everything. Although it is encircled by the clouds of darkness, of ignorance, sorrow, suffering, misery, folly, of the whole world, that we can never escape. And that ignorance and sin and folly of the whole world is also mine. I am totally and completely involved with the world. If I ever say that the world is thus, but I am thus, I'm a liar. To say nothing of the fact that I'm a fool, a self-deluded person. The world is me, I am the world. Then this light of transcendence brings about the true healing. I can't see it, I can't imagine it, I can't picture it. I mustn't try to picture it, because I shall only be imposing my intellectualist, desire-driven impulses upon the flow of life itself. These are things we don't see, you know, and it's very difficult. We are always caught napping throughout the day. The provocation of circumstance throughout the day, again and again, is of such a nature that we are constantly falling down. Like a little infant who is a little toddler who walks a few steps and falls down. When he is grown to physical maturity, he can walk and run with confidence. We, the human beings all over the globe, we never reach psychological maturity. Very, very few do. This is our task, to realize this psychological maturity. The psyche is purified, whole, complete. And then there is no separation between you, John Smith, or Mary Brown, and the rest of totality. And in that is fulfillment. Not your fulfillment, not my fulfillment, but the fulfillment of the totality. It has borne fruit. The purpose of you being produced by the universe comes to fruition in terms of the universe realizing the perfect thing through you, the finite, the temporal, the mortal one. That is the marvel of existence, and that is the religious life and the religious living and religious consciousness. This is exceptionally important because, as you know, the world today, if it lacks anything, it lacks moral backbone, first and foremost, from beginning to end. The world is an immoral world, which means I am. And morality is, as I've tried to suggest this evening, is not something which is imposed as a set of rules and concepts and ought to be. But seeing the real nature of things And in the seeing of the real nature of things, there inevitably emerges the rightest possible action, in thought and feeling, in word, and indeed in everyday life. And your instrument of salvation is your power of attention. Don't forget that. No one can attend on your behalf. All instructions that may be given to you are like, all the knowledge of history or mathematics or entomology which may be contained in a book, and you go and buy it and go have home very happy, put it on the top shelf, and it is on the top shelf, but it is not inside your head. That's all there is to it. So now this is the thing. Fairly and squarely on our own shoulders rests the total responsibility. Salvation does not come from outside. It does not come from inside. When outside and inside are only without out and in, then the whole thing comes to fruition.